Next case is United States v. Guardado. Is the appellant ready?
Yes, sir.
Is the government ready? Yes, sir. Appellant may argue.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Robert Feldmeyer. I represent Guardado. May it please the court. It is antithetical to the presumption of innocence to suggest that conduct of which an accused is presumed innocent may be used to show a propensity to have committed other conduct of which he is presumed innocent. In this case, the Army Court disregarded the clear command of this honorable court when it held that acquittal, as to other specifications of Charge 1, cured error, instructional error with regard to Charge 1, Specification 1, of which appellant was convicted, where the panel received an impermissible propensity instruction concerning all the charges.
Counsel, would you be willing to swing that microphone a little bit more towards you?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The Army Court additionally erred when it found that the trial judge's application of MRE 404B to the circumstances of this case did not trigger the Hills Doctrine with regard to additional Charge 2. I'll first address the Army Court's error concerning Charge 1, Specification 1, and then move on to additional Charge 2 and its specifications.
Counsel, before you go on that second part, is the second part of your presentation, in other words, the 404B part, is that beyond the scope of the granted issue?
Well, Your Honor, the granted issue was whether or not the Army Court erred in its holding with regard to Hills. And the Army Court applied Hills both to 404B and to 413.
You feel that because of that it's concluded within the granted issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, with regard to the MRE 413 instruction at issue here, the error was preserved when defense counsel objected to predator language, which the senior trial counsel utilized during his closing argument. During that closing argument, the senior trial counsel referenced the specifications of Charge 1 of which the appellant was acquitted. The senior trial counsel told the panel that appellant, quote, is a predator, has been preying on children for a long time. Predators tell victims, no one would believe them. And you saw what he did in this case, exactly what he was trained that predators do, unquote. Trial judge permitted the trial counsel to argue in this fashion over the objection of defense counsel, presumably utilizing his ruling on MRE on the MRE 413 propensity instruction that he had given to the panel.
Counsel, might in a different case under a different fact pattern, might a prosecutor, a trial counsel, where there is only one victim, refer to the accused as a predator? So that it doesn't necessarily mean that there was more than one victim involved.
I mean, the term itself doesn't necessarily mean, Your Honor, that there was more than one victim, but as the senior trial counsel used it here, he was clearly referencing propensity, that because there are all these victims and all these children, allegedly adolescents allegedly involved, that the accused, Sergeant Guardado, is a predator who likes children.
This is so it's not that use of that term, it's the context in which it was used.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. The Army Court erred in finding that there was no prejudice to the appellant on the basis of a five-part test, which is not, frankly, useful in determining prejudice. I'll address the Army Court's factors in its decision, Guardado, in order of their rising probative value. The first factor which the Army Court identified, that instructional error can be harmless, really isn't a factor at all. It's a truism that, yes, instructional error can be harmless. But that truism does not lead an appellate court to any clarity as to whether or not there has been prejudice. The fourth factor which the Army Court identified, whether or not it, in its factual sufficiency review, reaches the same conclusion as the panel, is also not a useful factor. A factual sufficiency review starts from a point of neutrality, not a presumption of innocence, unlike a panel's deliberations. The different standards that apply to a factual sufficiency review as opposed to a panel's deliberation mean that a factual sufficiency review cannot cure improper panel instructions.
Counsel, didn't the CCA include a footnote on that point saying that, hey, look, we're conducting our factual sufficiency review, but that should not suggest that we are using this as the reason for finding harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes, Your Honor, but it was one of the factors. And
your point, I'm not arguing with you. I'm just making an observation. If it wasn't of any value, and they seem to think that they're not using the factual sufficiency review to make a prejudice ruling, then why would they include it?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I'm not sure why.
As a factor.
I'm not sure why it's a factor, and I of course would agree with you, sir.
That was kind of a rhetorical question. I wasn't suggesting that you knew why they might do such a thing.
Yes, Your Honor. The third factor that the Army Court raised, that acquittal does not determine prejudice, that acquittal means that there was no prejudice, is not supported by the law. Consistent with the instructions which the military judge gave to the panel in this case, a panel certainly could both acquit and find propensity because of the different standards of proof involved. Take a case like this one where there is weak proof, but some proof elicited by the government for the charges of which the accused was acquitted. The panel could go ahead and acquit the accused, but applying a preponderance of the evidence standard, find that because some evidence was introduced by the government and no exculpatory evidence introduced by the defense, that by preponderance of the evidence, the government has met its burden to utilize propensity evidence. Of course, as this court held in both Dills and Huckle, the one problem with this is that it unconstitutionally infringes upon an accused's presumption of innocence and penalizes him for not submitting any exculpatory evidence. He's, of course, under no obligation to submit any evidence whatever to disprove his guilt.
Counsel, I'm just curious. In your recitation right there, you referred to an instance where government presents evidence, but the defense does not provide any evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're not saying that's required for there to be a preponderance. You're just saying that is a scenario that could occur.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Yes,
Your
Honor. Just wanted to be clear. The fifth factor which the Army Court identified, whether a spillover instruction is given, is but nominal utility. While I'd, of course, concede that a case in which a military judge gave a propensity instruction with no spillover instruction is even more prejudicial than the facts at issue here, the fact that a spillover instruction was given, as this court held in both Hills and Huckle, does not cure the improper instruction. Finally,
are you saying this spillover instruction or any spillover instruction? If a military judge were to craft a more extensive spillover instruction, could that cure it, or are you saying no?
I mean, the same contradictory instructions which this court identified in Hills would be at play with any spillover instruction. I mean, do one thing and then don't do it. Your Honor, I'd say that a spillover instruction cannot cure an improper propensity instruction. The final factor that the Army Court identified, its second factor, whether or not conduct is related, is a factor in determining prejudice, but I'd respectfully submit to the honorable members of this court that unrelated misconduct has a greater likelihood of propensity of a panel using the improper propensity evidence when it's instructed that it may do so. Take the hypothetical example of an accused who faces one specification of Article 120, one specification of Article 125, and it's alleged that choking is the means by which, the force by which the accused accomplished both offenses. A panel is less likely to use propensity evidence in that circumstance because the choking goes to the elements of both offenses. It's less likely to make the logical jump to propensity when it instead can use the evidence towards the elements of the offenses. In unrelated cases, there is absolutely no logical connection between the unrelated offenses other than propensity. If the panel is told that it can do this, it's more likely that it will.
Counsel, let me ask you this. What do you make of the CCA's observation that an acquittal, as you had in this case, of these three other offenses, of the four, three of them are acquittals, what do you make of their observation that the acquittals are not much different than if these offenses had not been charged at all, were being brought in as uncharged acts?
I mean, Your Honor,
first of all, do you agree with me that they kind of make that observation? And what do you make of it?
I do agree they kind of made that observation, but I'd respectfully submit that it's not an accurate one when the panel is essentially given a, if there's smoke, there might be fire instruction. The panel was told in this case that using a lesser standard of proof, it could find that these offenses may have occurred and that therefore the accused has propensity to commit these type of offenses. So I'd respectfully disagree with the honorable judges in the Army Court of Criminal Appeals that an acquittal means that the panel found that these offenses didn't occur at all. An acquittal means that the panel found they weren't proved beyond a reasonable doubt. Just as in Hills, there were no eyewitnesses in this case as to Specification 1, Charge 1. There was no physical evidence as to Specification 1, Charge 1. The complaining witness's account of the incident varied over time and depending on to whom the person to whom she was speaking. She was under the strong influence of her mother, who at the time was undergoing a contentious divorce from the accused and had a reason to improperly influence her daughter. Members of this court, I respectfully submit that you cannot be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that there was no prejudice from the improper instruction and that the results beyond a reasonable doubt would have been exactly the same without it. Therefore, this court should set aside and dismiss.
I'll ask you one other question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Before you wrap up. I think you're getting ready to wrap up. Your position is that even though, the members would have found the accused not guilty of these other offenses, in other words, not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, that nonetheless they could still consider that, well, maybe it did happen by a preponderance, and then use that with regard to Specification 1. Is that your view?
Exactly, Your Honor.
I just wondered, because that's a fair amount of mental calisthenics that a layperson would have to go through. Well, and we have no way of knowing what they were thinking, of course. Right?
And it's the government's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they didn't think that. And there's no evidence in this case that they didn't.
And, counsel, that was consistent with the instructions, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Of what they were supposed to do.
Yes, Your Honor. And we presume that a panel follows its instructions, absent evidence to the contrary.
Let me go back to your burden question point. Isn't this a plain error case? Defense counsel did not object to the instructions?
Well, again, Your Honor, I respectfully direct the court to the defense counsel's objection to the improper argument. Court is not convinced by that argument, if we were to apply a plain error test, applying the third factor, whether or not, I mean, this court's already held its error and the error is plain, but applying the third factor, prejudice, the argument itself is profound prejudice. The highly inflammatory comments of the senior trial counsel, in fact, whom this court in another case has sanctioned for making, has pointed out, has made highly inflammatory cases.
Well, we can't use that, can we?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Well, I just want to know.
But just examining these comments on their face, they were highly inflammatory, highly prejudicial. That is the prejudice which shifts the burden to the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the improper instruction played no role in this matter. Government can't meet that burden, and therefore this court should set aside and dismiss Charge 1, Specification 1. Moving very quickly to the MRE 404B issue, members of the court, a rose by any other name would smell just as sweet, and a propensity instruction by any other MRE is just as unconstitutional when applied to charged misconduct. The military judge instructed the panel that it could consider whether appellant has a desire to, quote, flirt with teenage girls, unquote. This was a propensity instruction which concerned the gratification of sexual desires element for specifications 1 and 2 and additional charge 2. The mere shifting of the label from 413 or 414 to 404B doesn't cure the improper instruction. Legitimate MRE 404B evidence deals with evidence of acts so specific to an accused that it's as if it's his calling card, not with a general propensity to flirt with teenage girls. This goes directly to the element of both specifications of additional charge 2, the gratification of sexual desires, this court has held that a propensity instruction with regard to charge misconduct can't be used for that purpose.
So is it your view that this just added another layer of confusion for the members?
Yes, Your Honor, especially since the military judge did not instruct the panel as to what standard of proof they should use with regard to this 404B evidence. He gave the 413 and 414 instruction and the 404B instruction back-to-back. In the absence of any different standard of proof, it's completely likely that the panel just utilized the preponderance of the evidence standard on which it was instructed with regard to the 413 evidence. This standard is unconstitutional and invites a panel to lower the standard of proof. Just the fact that it's a 404B case here, it was a 404B instruction, not a 413, doesn't cure the constitutional error. This court should set aside and dismiss charge 1, specification 1, additional charge 2, and its specifications because of the instructional error present here. I see that my time has expired. Any questions from the court?
I have one question.
Yes, Your Honor.
I know we didn't ask for briefing on the second issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you prepared to argue the second issue? Can you give me 30 to 45 seconds on the second issue?
Well, this court has held in cases subsequent to Guardado that the preemption doctrine indeed survives. Indeed survives post-Fossler, and that the preemption doctrine indeed is a valid doctrine internal to Article 134. The President has required the indecency element with regard to speech, and he has in the past eliminated elements with regard to speech. Creative trial counsel can't strip away the indecency element to create new charges here. This court's held that it is a jurisdictional matter, and the court below was without jurisdiction to try that matter.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that exactly what was said about Reese? You talked about Reese, correct?
There are several subsequent cases, Your Honor. I believe Reese was.
Well, in Reese, the government said that they were trying to charge obstruction of justice, right? But then they left out the criminal parts of obstruction of justice. Is it your position that there's no language that service discrediting or prejudicial to good order and discipline that isn't also indecent?
I mean, it's my position, at least here, that where the charge is dealt with indecency-like specifications, that President has preempted the creation of a new offense to deal with salty language.
I thought that it was, I didn't think that we talked about it as jurisdictional. I thought that we talked about, we said the preemption is distinct from the provisions of Article 134, which prohibits the government from using a novel specification. You don't think that's the same thing as preemption?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I'm fully tracking your
okay,
question.
Okay, that's fine. We didn't ask you to brief it. It's fine.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Government may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Austin Fenwick, along with Major Michael Cordy. It is my privilege to represent the United States. Before starting with the rest of the outline, there's some disagreement over the standard of review today. Certainly at ACCA, both parties briefed it as being objected to a trial, and so the government's position is this was not plain error, and so we're stuck with the beyond a reasonable doubt standard today. I wish it was different. It's not, but it seems unfair to change that now today at this court. This case is not the same as Hills or Hugel. You had a 15-year-old girl come up, and she gave clear, confident, and candid testimony. The defense was not able to impeach her testimony in any way substantively at all. And the panel was left with strong evidence that appellant in this case had committed this crime against his daughter when she was 10 on her birthday. The other 120 offenses in this case that are at issue here were supported by extraordinarily weak evidence. It wasn't just some evidence. It was pretty bad evidence and very weak. You can look at JA 84, where CH is talking about having been touched while she was a goalie. And the testimony she gave was that she didn't ever distinguish between whether the contact was intentional or not. And that was the substance of the testimony that the panel was left with for that victim. It's not reasonable to believe that the panel somehow gave weight to that and decided it was more than 50%.
Counsel, I understand your argument that it was extremely weak evidence, and therefore it really would not have served as propensity evidence in the mind of the panel members. But isn't there a flip side of that argument? Trial counsel is presumed to know the quality of the evidence before he goes forward with the case. Both here during oral argument and in your own brief, you characterize the evidence with those two charges as extremely weak. Why shouldn't that cause us concern that a trial counsel is going forward with charges that the government itself is saying were extremely weak? Why doesn't that lead us to conclude that, in fact, the trial counsel was proceeding with those charges for the express purpose of dirtying up the defendant, that was seeking to use this tactically as propensity evidence all the way along?
Yes, sir. There's certainly a way that you could look at it, but that's not supported by the record. It could be that pre-trial facts came out differently. As we all know, as cases are developing, they can sometimes appear better. And there's no way, in fact, it appears from the record that the trial counsel didn't speak to the witness who came to say, I saw VC on top of appellant. It appeared like he didn't even talk to that witness until the day before trial. And so certainly when that case was charged, when it got referred, when they were preparing for trial, it does not appear as though the special victim prosecutor in this case knew there was some witness out there who was going to come in and say, with no apparent motive to fabricate, that I saw them having consensual intercourse that night and nothing weird happened.
But you're saying trial counsel knew the day before?
Yes, sir.
Is there anything that prohibited trial counsel from dropping that charge ahead of time?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
So should we be concerned that here the trial counsel is not pursuing this case, not investigating, but still charging it, and then coming up with extremely weak evidence, and here we are dealing with this issue of propensity? Should we be concerned that this was a tactical decision to dirty up the accused in this case?
There is no way of knowing for sure whether or not that took place, Your Honor. It certainly is something out there, and it certainly wouldn't be unreasonable for this court to think that, but I'm unclear as to how that would apply to this case when that evidence still came out weak and you still had the panel going back and being told you have to find 51% likely or by a preponderance that this took place at all. So whether or not that was the plan, I can't speak to that. It appears as though there's argument that it wasn't.
Can I direct you to another point in your brief? You say it's not reasonable to assume that the panel believed that appellant raped VC by preponderance of the evidence, but then acquitted him of the higher beyond a reasonable doubt standard. Could you explain, please, what you were trying to convey?
Yes, sir. So it was, simply put, that was an all or nothing charge. You had her coming in saying, this took place, I woke up with him on top of me after being drugged, presumably. And she's saying that it's difficult to understand how a panel would have believed her enough to get past preponderance and then say, but we don't think that this goes beyond a reasonable doubt when this is a case based on testimony, Your Honor.
So from your perspective, it was a binary choice?
Yes, sir, exactly.
But how do we know what's going on in the mind of panel members?
We don't know, and in most cases it's going to be very difficult for this court to figure out and for the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, disprove the negative in this case. But we're left with a case here.
So does that cause you problems when it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard that we're applying here?
Yes, Your Honor. It does.
I admire your honesty.
Counsel, what if any weight should we give to the fact that the CCA specifically made a factual finding about the credibility of the victim for the charge of which he was convicted?
Well, certainly we believe that she was very credible, and they...
I don't care what you think. I'm asking you about what weight should we give. I mean, it's not that I don't care what you think, but it's not relevant. I'm asking you what relevance do we give to the fact that the CCA said she was very credible.
It certainly was part of their test, Your Honor, and I think you should consider that when you're testing their ruling. And again, we don't want to characterize those five factors as a hard and fast test because the CCA does not. It appears more as though they're showing their work. I mean, when one of those factors is that it has to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, that's what we're here today to do. So it just appears as though that the judges in this case were showing y'all how they got there.
So what you're saying is with those five factors, they were not providing a rubric for application in the future. They were simply pointing out in their opinion how they reached their bottom line.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because I have a lot of trouble understanding the first sentence that they have after we are unable to articulate any prejudice, or stated differently, if propensity evidence is permissible, had the other offense has been uncharged, we can find no legal difference as to this specification because of the unrelated charge. I mean, that, would you agree that that sentence makes very little sense?
I don't know that I would say that, Your Honor. I think that
oh, that's right. You have to appeal before them to I don't. Forget about that.
But what I would say is that there's a very clear difference between acquitted misconduct and uncharged misconduct. One is on a charge sheet and one is not. So,
Counsel, I've got a lot of experience with 404B type. And very little with 413 and 414. Kind of came late in my career. But let's assume that the trial counsel had looked at his case and said, I've got a weak case, so I'm going to drop the charges, but I'm still going to introduce these other three girls as propensity evidence. Could he have done that?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what role does a military judge, what kind of gate does he hold to that evidence? Does the judge himself have to decide that this is competent evidence before he lets it in?
Yes, sir.
And then he instructs that they have to be convinced by preponderance of the evidence that the conduct took place?
Yes, sir. Same exact instruction, just with uncharged misconduct versus charged in this case. So what the government wants to emphasize today is that...
Let me follow up on Judge Cox's question. Isn't that one of the concerns, then, that unlike the situation with uncharged conduct, where the military judge is making a gateway decision, when the offenses are already charged, they're already in, the evidence comes in, however weak or strong it is, and the members are then allowed to make this preponderance determination. Isn't that what makes it a problem, you think? This whole notion that Judge Cox just raised, that there's no one to kind of regulate whether or not the jury hears this stuff or not.
Well, it's still regulated, Your Honor, by the judge. Even when it's charged, the problem with charged conduct is that it kind of in runs around some of the factors for uncharged conduct. Because again, you are obviously already going to be introducing it, so you get past the factor of wasting the court's time and those sorts of things. But in this case, it probably turned out, honestly, better for the appellant that this stuff came in, because then there was an opportunity to test this evidence, whereas with uncharged, there wouldn't have been here.
Well, we'll ask appellate defense counsel if that was the case or not. But
they still have to get the propensity instruction. They still have to. The military judge has to conduct the gatekeeping function before he gives a propensity instruction. Am I correct about that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Whether it's charged or uncharged.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well,
he has nothing to do with whether it's on the charge sheet, but in order to get for him to give the propensity instruction, that weighing analysis has to be undertaken, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. Did that
happen in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, and it did. And it's discussed on the record, which is not in the joint appendix, but it's at 183 and 184.
Can the court avoid creating a bright-line rule that charged misconduct in the same case may not be considered as propensity evidence by getting out of this case some other way?
Well,
the reason I ask that, let's say you have a serial rapist who used exactly the same method of operation in each case, and he's charged with 10 serial rapes using the same method of operation in each case. A bright line rule would say they can't consider those other 9 for the 10th one. It seems to me like there are circumstances, maybe. I just hadn't thought this all the way through, but some circumstances where it would be appropriate to look at that as 404B evidence,
yep,
as well as propensity evidence.
There is likely a way to look at some of this 413 stuff as 404B if a trial counsel puts in the work to develop it more, because frankly the burden for 404B is a little bit higher than 413 as far as what they need to jump through.
Well, and 404B, it's not used to show propensity, right? I mean, it's specifically precluded from using it as propensity evidence. They can only use it to show modus operandi or that it was an absence of mistake, et cetera, that they could argue, if it came in that way, they would be able to argue, you know, that these crimes were all committed exactly the same way.
Yes, ma'am. Yes.
So it's likely that the same person did them.
Right. So, yes, ma'am.
And then 413, if it happened to be a sex crime, gives you the extra way of using it, right? You can use it, like Judge Ryan pointed out, to prove lack of mistake, motive, opportunity, blah, blah, blah. But you can also use it to prove propensity if it meets 413, right?
If it's uncharged, Your Honor. Yes, sir. Okay. And so...
Well, there's nothing in... So you're saying it can't be used if it's charged?
Yes, Your Honor. It can't be used to show propensity.
If it's charged?
Right, yes, Your Honor.
So you want us to create a bright line rule.
Hill says, I'm pretty sure Hill says you can't use it.
Hills and Huckel. Yes, ma'am.
But Hills can be distinguished, can't it?
Well, not after Huckel. No, Your Honor. That's
wasn't it the same chat? Wasn't it the same person in Hills?
It was, but that wasn't. But then Huckel made that even more apparent, Your Honor, where it just said you can't ever do it. Doesn't matter what.
Okay.
Who it is and multiple people.
Well, I'll confess, I've not studied Hills as deeply as I should.
The government's position, as I understand it, is not that there wasn't error, but simply that it was HBRD.
Exactly, Your Honor.
In the end.
Yes, sir.
The judge erred.
Yes, sir.
But in the end, it was HBRD. That's the government's position.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Along those lines, can you spell out to us why, you think the government's case was so strong?
Yes, sir. So unlike Hills and Huckel, both of which had adult victims with alcohol-fueled offenses, and they had given contradictory statements and stories, and they had multiple ways of being impeached. Here you had a 15-year-old girl who came in and said, on my 10th birthday, my father took me out, and he did this to me. I didn't say anything about it right away because I didn't know how to feel about it. She had never, and despite this proposition by appellant now that she gave these vastly different stories, the only other different story she gave was when she told her boyfriend about this. And the most they could get out of them at trial was that she had said, I was raped. And when we're talking about lay people and when someone's describing such an emotional event, saying that you were raped versus that you had been touched by her father under aggravated sexual contact is not something...
I thought the record reflected more than that. She just used the term rape, that she described as sexual intercourse. Am I mistaken in that?
No, sir. There was discussion by the defense counsel where he was trying to cross the boyfriend saying, didn't she tell you it was sex? And the answer that witness repeatedly gave was, no, she never said sex. She said, I was raped. And so there was they tried to get that point across, Your Honor, but that wasn't what came out.
So what are we to make of the fact, though, in terms of HBRD, that the allegation first surfaces 5 years later, there's no other witness, the defense avers that there was a motive for the victim to raise this issue, and so forth?
Well, the motive issue, if you look at the record of trial, is non-existent.
The relationship with the mother and the mother's relationship with the appellant?
That apparently was already done by the time that this happened, even during her 10th birthday. And then when she was crossed on this by the defense counsel, she said, yeah, I've talked with my mom about this many times. The only thing she's ever said to me is I need to go in and tell the truth. She didn't even report this to her mom or law enforcement. There was a note found by the mom at some point. And so there's no way to hook this with the mom in this case as much as the defense tried to. The most about this watching America's Most Wanted or whatever the show was that led to this was KG saying, that helped me understand what happened to me. It wasn't even that my mom brought me in and said, has this ever happened to you? It just didn't have anything to do with the mom other than there was a divorce that had been contentious and they didn't like each other.
So getting back, you were on a train of thought about why it's so strong. Right now you're talking about why it wasn't weak. But why is it strong?
Yes, Your Honor. I think those two kind of come together on this because strong testimony is not only testimony that is, again, clear and confident and candid, but it's also testimony that survives and looks better even on cross-exam because it just can't do anything to you. And when there's a defense counsel and a panel sees that cross-exam, and the only thing they're getting out of it is something about being mad about iTunes, when you have a girl coming in and saying that her father did something like this to you, that does strengthen it. It's not just that it's not weak in that case, Your Honor. And as far as how we can get inside the mind of the panel here to the extent that, that we can. You can look at Joint Appendix 204, where she's actually talking about what happened to her. And the trial counsel asks her, how sure are you that your father touched your vagina? And she says, I am 100% certain. The next question is, how sure are you that he penetrated you however slight? And she says, I'm pretty sure. And the simple fact is that pretty sure plus propensity would have equaled a conviction here on the penetrative sexual act, and it didn't. They found him guilty of the lesser included that she said, I am 100% certain of. And so we can drill down in the record of trial here and see that this panel was not listening to all the noise maybe coming from the government in some parts on this case, and was listening to what people said. And you can see that not only for KG, but you can see it in CH, the soccer player, where you had him convicted of saying indecent things to her, but acquitted of the 120s. Because again, her testimony was, I don't ever know if it was intentional or not. And so in some cases, and maybe in most, it's going to be very hard for the government to come in here and show this court, here's how the panel did their work. We know that this instruction didn't impact anything, but here, that's not the case. And this is not the same kind of victim as it was in either Hills or in Tupel.
Captain, you're not saying that maybe the members just ignored the military judge's instruction, or I can see why they would, but is that what you're saying? They just ignored the instruction and went on and did what they normally do when they hear testimony and receive evidence? Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying here is that it's clear that the members understood the instruction to find everything individually beyond reasonable doubt, and they weren't influenced by this erroneous instruction. And again, from my brief, I say in my brief, you know, we don't think that when they went back and did this calculation, however that's getting done back in panel rooms, that they even found there was evidentiary value to be used from the other three 120 charges for those two.
What about appellate defense counsel's position that you simply cannot know that if, even though they acquitted him of the three other offenses, his position, I believe, is that notwithstanding that, they could have still concluded that those offenses were committed by a preponderance and nonetheless used it against the accused on this specification, again, notwithstanding the fact that they found him guilty of a lesser included offense?
Well, I don't think you need to know for sure, Your Honor. Our burden is high, but it's not that high.
Not that high?
And I think that here you can look at the record and see what they did. And not only see what the panel did, but you can look at this evidence. And this court can see that those charges would not have met that level of certainty for any panel because they were so weak.
I have one last question, Chief. If he had been convicted of the three offenses, would it still have been error to give the propensity instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. I think here the fact that he wasn't convicted of everything is frankly why we're able to send it here today.
So one of the dangers in military law of the rule that requires charging all known offenses is you have an automatic spillover effect whether you get a propensity instruction or not in the minds of a reasonable man. Don't you?
I certainly think that there is probably some level of that, but the panel is told in every case, Your Honor, that they're not allowed to consider that other evidence to show that he was more likely. And I assume that they followed it here because, again, you have a case with a guy who is facing a lot of charges, and you have a panel going through and making different decisions for different victims based on the strength of the evidence that came out on trial. Pending any further questions.
Thank you. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
I have a question for you. Under what would tip the balance in your view to make this harmless beyond reasonable doubt?
I mean, it's...
Because it almost seems as though you're saying that per se, that it's a per se rule. If there's instructional error of this nature, that therefore it cannot be harmless beyond reasonable doubt.
I think a hypothetical case, Your Honor, where charged misconduct had no proof elicited to it, where the government charged somebody, but then for whatever reason, be it inadvertence or lack of proof, didn't elicit any evidence at trial, then that would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But as the government counsel indicated, the burden is very high, and I'll freely concede that in many of the cases which this honorable court will review, that the government will not be able to meet that standard simply because it is so high. I also wanted, Your Honor, to briefly address the government counsel's contention that the evidence here was strong. In addition to the factors that I already discussed, that there was no physical evidence and no eyewitnesses, I would respectfully non-concur with the government counsel's contention that her previous account didn't contradict her in-court testimony. Her in-court testimony, she stated that the assault occurred while she was driving, that she didn't have much reaction, that she was clothed, and that it was touching. She told her boyfriend that there was sex involved, that her father pulled off her clothes, that it occurred while she was parked, and that she started crying. These are great divergences between the two accounts and further call into question the strength of the evidence.
Counsel, I have one question. Again, it's my lack of experience in 413 area. If the trial counsel at the beginning of the trial or before the trial started dismissed those three charges because he didn't feel like he had sufficient evidence to prove them beyond a reasonable doubt, and then said, but, Your Honor, I'm calling these three young women to show similarity in under 413 for a sex offense, the judge then has the duty to decide if it meets the threshold, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if he does decide that and lets it in, would it be error?
In this case particularly, Your Honor?
No, I'm just saying, generally speaking, if he had dropped the charges, because as I understand what the argument is, you couldn't use it for propensity evidence because it was charged misconduct. If he had dropped the charges, then that exact same evidence could have come in as propensity evidence, couldn't it?
Assuming it meets the...
Maybe have come in.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor, because...
And then it wouldn't be any error at all, would it?
I mean, there'd no longer be a presumption of innocence. Yeah. But the problem here is that with charges that to which the presumption of innocence was attached, it invites the panel to not have a presumption of innocence for certain aspects.
Okay.
Your Honor, very briefly answer your question. I did have a chance to quickly review my notes on preemption, and I just did want to highlight that the gravamen of the offense here was indecency. And while it might be theoretically possible to come up with a speech offense that, A, isn't preempted by congressional enactments on insubordination or contempt towards officials, or by the president's definition of the offense here, that's not what we have here, because the gravamen of the offense was indecency, and the government dropped that charge. I think there's a strong case to be made, although I don't need to make it in order to prevail. Just to re-raise the point that the president at one point considered insulting speech to be within the purview of Article 134 and dropped that requirement several years back. So the president...
The answer to my question is, I think, then no, right? That there is, that you could not find that speech that wasn't indecent.
I'm struggling to think up what it is, and even if you could, in this case, the gravamen of the offense is indecency, and you can't come up with another indecent speech offense.
Well, and what you're saying then is that this allows the government to get around proving indecency.
Yes, sir.
Right.
Barring further questions from the court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is now submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Court will be in recess until 11:15.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 11:15.